This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 464, AI Piano Man. Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin. I am one of the two Michael versions of your co-hosts, and our third co-host, Mr. Andy Piper, is unfortunately not with us today. We're missing him. Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Glad to have you back after your sojourns last week.
Yeah,
and we're excited to get right into it this week. So let's lock and load.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a great show here for everybody, and we're going to start off with a few AI related things, which you might have guessed from the title of the show. The first of which is so many AI related gadgets are coming out these days, and we have the Rabbit R1, which is a little bit different than the AI pin, although it's something that you can wear and you can have on you, and it does a number of things like the pin does, but a few things not so much like what the pin does. It's trying to be a much more targeted, you know. Is this something, Michael, that you would want to have in your arsenal of gadgetry?
No, but we did talk about this when they showcased it at CES back in January, right? This was the next best thing. It was I can never remember the, was it Teenage Engineering or something like that?
Yes,
the company that designed it. And what's interesting about it, unlike the Humane AI pen, this one is significantly cheaper. So yep, it's $200 instead of $700. Doesn't require a data plan, so it leverages your existing connected device and is not trying to be a complete replacement for your connected device. As well, as you mentioned, it's targeted around specific APIs and features. It does have a camera, so it is able to do some of the recognition things. And it has a screen instead of trying to, you know, broadcast something onto your hand badly.
Right.
The thing about all these devices, and we talked about this when we talked about the Humane Pin, is I don't see the need for them, given that all they're doing is front-ending some LLM tool, right? And I can do all of that with my watch or my phone. Right.
Yes.
And so it's another device that I don't need to carry around
with another battery that you need to charge.
Yep.
The case, I saw the case of it somewhere else, and that the case seemed to be pretty cool too, because it could, you know, stand up nicely. But you're right.
It kind of reminds you of the, what's the gaming case, the one that Andy has with the little spinner on the side. I don't know if you got one of those.
I didn't. I thought about it. I know what you're talking
Me
about.
Too.
This was a Teenage Engineering thing with a crank handle and all that stuff too. Yeah, you're right. It is an extra thing. It does duplicate what you already have on your wrist or in your pocket. And if you're asking for it to play a song or to find you some information about something, can you get that through other ways? I'm still intrigued. I'm still intrigued by what the Humane AI pin is trying to accomplish about getting people off their screens. That's still, as we've talked about before, is far away. So I looked at this. It looked cool. They've got some nice graphics to it. Don't know that I would spend money on it.
Don't need another piece of hardware. And if I want to get off my screen, I have my watch. I can talk to my watch.
Which is still a screen.
Well, yeah, so is this. This has a screen, and the AI pin has a screen. It just projects it onto your hand. So they're not getting rid of your screen.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fallacy.
I guess you're right.
But it is kind of, I mean, it's a cool looking device, but yeah, whatever.
So we have another cool looking device, which is another piece of hardware. In this case, it is a mouse, right? Oh, and you're showing me a mouse.
Yes.
And it's you're showing me a Logitech mouse too, right?
I am showing you a Logitech mouse, and I think it has all the same buttons as you see in the article.
Does it? But does it include the AI button on your mouse?
Oh, there? I don't install their software.
Oh. Well,
because this mouse will just work as a Bluetooth mouse. I don't need to install their custom software, which is what this is all about, right?
Well, it is and it isn't. So I see it as two levels. So does your mouse have a prescribed AI button on it?
It has a button that I can program.
Okay, so you could change the button to say shut my machine down or launch your favorite website, gamesatwork.biz.
Absolutely. A matter of fact, it has 10 buttons on it.
Yes. So remember when?
Back in the day,
you would get like a new TV or something, and the new TV would have a remote on. That you would get, and the remote would have something on it like Netflix as a distinct button, right?
Yes.
So it's a little kitschy, I guess, in that way that you would have a bespoke button to do one particular task. And to me, the color that they're using and the structure that they're using, we'll get to the software in a second, but the whole idea of saying, here's a button to go do something AI related. So I see this as a arc that belongs with the rabbit, belongs with the humane pin, belongs with other stuff that says, I am doing a task, not task rabbit. That's something else.
You mean like the AI button on the new Windows laptops?
Yes. I'm doing a task. And is AI applicable here? And I don't want it to intrude on everything that I'm doing. Hey, tap, tap, tap. It looks like you're trying to write a letter. I want it to intrude when I want it to intrude, right? So it might be, hey, I'm going to select a bunch of text, and then I hit the AI button, and it may well infer that what I want to do is tighten that text up, right? Or it may infer that I would like to have an image created from a prompt, which is now interpreting what I've done. So those are the intriguing things that I like here, because I like the idea of not having AI interrupt my workflow, but rather be called up when I'd like it to be and not called up when I don't.
Well, come on. Can't you just hit Command Control Option Shift A plus I on your keyboard?
With my nose.
No, the thing that kills me about this is, yes, you can get a lot of press about adding a special button on your mouse. And all they did is they took their, you know, I have the, I don't even know what model this is, but it's the MX Master 3. Mm-hmm. And the keyboard, the mouse that they're here is the M557, right? Is one of the examples. And basically there's the 750. They're all the same, right? They're highly programmable mice with lots and lots of buttons, usually designed for gaming or if you're doing some kind of graphics work, whatever.
Right.
And the idea is they've extended their desktop software to hook into one of the buttons, and they default it to the little top center button that's in between your two fingers when you naturally rest the mouse, your hand on the mouse.
Yep.
And so they get a lot of play in the press because they have an AI button. No, they've taken their existing mouse, they colored one of the buttons, and they updated the software. Next week, that software could be the graphics generator button or the, you know, turn off the power of my house button, right? It doesn't really matter. And I just personally think, yeah, like the action button on your watch or on your phone to be. But the whole thing is,
that was the visual for Michael and for those of you who are watching.
Yeah, the programmable button. That's not news. The fact that they said, oh, we'll out of the box of our new software revision allow the programmable button to be a prompt builder button. Fine. Wonderful. You've updated your software. That's okay. I'm okay with that. Now, there's other stories we're not going to get into about what they expose by doing that in their button pressing, but you may want to go head over to 512 Pixels on that one.
Yeah. So let's continue on just a little bit more about bespoke haptic and tactile feeling of things. And
yes,
we have a really cool article here about a way of learning how to play piano wearing gloves that help you haptically learn how to play. And it's not just the piano. They give other examples of other instruments and things like that that you could do. I could see this working really well for a three-valved instrument, you know, say a sousaphone or something like that. Probably even better.
Or a trumpet.
Those are small. We call those piccolo sousaphones. I think for piano and for keyboarding, it requires a whole bunch of compute power to kind of know where your hand is in space and, you know, are you hovering over middle C or not? And did you move yourself in the right direction? But it's better. It's better. And if you combine that with keyboards that also light up and give you that haptic and tactile feedback, could this speed learning? It feels like the answer is yes.
Yeah, when I saw this in Scientific America this week, I was like, this is definitely for the show. And the part that I liked was the training that they did, right? They had the piano instructor kind of train the system wearing the gloves. Mm-hmm. So it picked up the haptic feel. And there's, I'm sure, other sensors, as you say, on positioning on the keyboard, et cetera. And then used that information to prod the student improving their skills as they were doing it. And I thought that was really cool because I've tried to learn how to play the piano. Mm-hmm. And I play a mean radio, but maybe not a piano. Let's put it that way. I can play like chopsticks and maybe a few other things, but nothing meaningful. And I think the ability to utilize haptics in general for a feedback mechanism and to improve a process is a great use of haptics, right? So whether we're talking about I've been trying to do some appropriate haptic feedback in one of my apps that I've written, and I can never figure out what the right feedback is, right? Because it's not intuitive for that app, even though when you look at design principles on iOS, as an example, or on VisionOS, having some kind of haptic or other feedback mechanism through an animation or a sound or whatever is critical to help people learn how to use a new piece of software. And so when we go from the, and this ties back to the rabbit, right? The idea of hardware as a mechanism to get people to train to do something new, and software as a mechanism to train to do things differently. I find it easier in software, but there are some where only hardware can do it, right? And that's why, you know, the feedback, that physical taptic feedback or haptic feedback can help you with mechanical processes like playing the piano, but probably not so much with things like prompt building.
Yeah, maybe not. It talks about here about fingertip vibrations, but I kind of wonder if it's like the top of your finger. So that way, you know, to press.
It feels like it's tapping you down,
right? And there are certain keyboards from Yamaha and a whole bunch of others that mimic the feel of keyboards as well, real keyboards, right?
What's really interesting, years ago, I was helping the church I was at pick out a new pipe organ.
Ooh.
And we were going back and forth between, are we going to go for pipe or are we going to go for an electric with lots of speakers, which is what they came from.
Yeah.
The play of the keyboard as you pressed it down and then the air blew across the pipe, right? Mm-hmm. That was something that electronic keyboards were desperately trying to mimic to get the feel in the keystroke going down versus the mechanical feel at the time of an actual depression that caused a pipe to open.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, that whole discussion. Nowadays, most, just like in cars, most of that's fly-by-wire anyway. So the keyboard would press down to an electrical signal that then sent over a message that then moved the lever on the pipe to blow the air across. But very interesting. And I like the idea of tapping on top of the finger versus on the bottom of the finger.
Super interesting. And you're right. These are, you know, big old challenges for how do you take something very analog, like air blowing across a pipe to create a sound, and that varies based upon how you press it, press the key on the keyboard, and how you have the stops pulled, to something that is more digital. So cool stuff. More of this, I'm sure, to come. And I could see where gloves like this are certainly serving a function that your watch or your phone or your rabbit aren't necessarily going to, you know, help you with. Next in our list of AI related stuff here was a post that I found by Chip Huynh, I'm guessing is how to pronounce his name, talking about measuring personal growth. And you talked a little bit about you learning to play the piano, and you probably wanted to learn to play the piano, but you didn't want to learn bad enough in order to really like throw yourself at it, you know, whole hog.
Yep.
And there is such a lovely graphic image in this particular article. I'm not going to dwell on the whole thing, but the image I love so much because it's talking about your life path. And if you're doing something where you are giving a lecture or speech, a commencement address, we're almost at graduation time for, you know, colleges and for high schools and stuff. Oftentimes the speaker will talk about, you know, how did they arrive at where they've arrived? And it might look in retrospect like it was a very, very clear path. But the reality is wherever you are in your life, there are branches that go in many, 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 many different directions. And I'm not going to go all Loki on you and, you know, do that version of the timeline and how do we prune ourselves into what should be the timeline. But it is an incredibly interesting notion around how is AI looking at all possible futures, positioning itself maybe into the future state, however far in the future it is, then drawing a path back to the present to help make recommendations that could get you to that potential outcome. And I love this image so much, and I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to chat about it at least for a moment.
Yeah, and it's a great image for an audio podcast.
Yeah.
But it's really cool, and you know it's a slightly different view than what I always think about, which is kind of the hourglass. Now is the center, and there's all these things behind you and all these things in front of you of an hourglass. Mm-hmm. But they actually make it better. They're saying, you know, you are here, and you didn't have 1,000 paths that got you here. You got there via one path. Now, it had a lot of branches along the way that you made decision points on.
Yeah.
And so going forward, there's all the branches, and you will eventually collapse those into the path that you end on. But there's always infinite number of branches ahead of you, too. And infinite's an overstatement, but you got the idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. And just the connection into how AI can operate to help people understand. And we are an audio podcast, but that's why we try to paint with words here so that you get a chance.
And go to our show notes.
Yeah,
check them out. GamesAtWork.biz.
So Michael, we have not talked much about Vision Pro as of late. And there's been a number of articles and videos and comparisons and stories here as of late. So can we get kind of your perspective on how things are going, how you're using your Vision Pro, and what your general sense of spatial computing is at this point in time?
Yeah, there's a couple of really good articles, and I'll summarize the articles real quick and then give my perspective. One is from Cultimac, which talks about the slowdown in demand of the Vision Pro headset, which I'll hit that in a second. The second is an article from a fan of the show and friend of the show, Ian Hughes, who pinged us one, which was a video review of the Meta Quest 3 and the Vision Pro. And there's many other ones that are out there. I'm trying to think if we had another one in our links. We've got the upcoming iPad event, which I think may actually be also a Vision Pro event to some degree. So there's a feeling by some in the Vision Pro space that, oh my God, the shipments are slowing down and the orders are slowing down. Well, I don't care about that, and I don't think that's an issue because they still only are available in one country, and that's the U.S. And the pent-up demand by developers was achieved. So the estimate, I think, is about 150,000 units were sold, which for a brand new piece of hardware that's $3,500 that doesn't have a lot of software for it out of the box, 150,000 units of mostly massive enthusiasts and developers, I think is pretty darn good in a couple of months. Because that's the people who are going to make the things that'll make it better. And I think I talked about, I can't remember if it was last week or some time ago, there's a Gucci app on the Vision Pro that is fantastic. What they do, it's a video ad app for a new designer at Gucci. Okay. And what they did is, you know, typical put a video on a prim, back to our Second Life days. Yep. But as you're watching stuff, periodically you get immersed in the environment. So you're watching one scene, they're like, we're getting ready for the show and it started raining, and suddenly there's rain falling all around you. As you're watching the video, there's other one that we're saying, and you know, we were going to this one open air thing to set up, and suddenly the screen expands and you're standing in the middle of this open air area and you can look around but still look forward to watch the video. And so they changed the interaction, and at many places during it, they're, you know, here's some shoes they're talking about, and you can grab the shoes, pick them up and look at them, and you know, all the things that you would expect for 3D objects. And so to me, those are the experiments that are happening to see what you can do cool in an immersive environment like this. You mentioned before the show the Masters app.
Right.
And I saw a review on that one. I'm not a big fan of the Masters. I've been to it in the past for work.
Yeah,
in a support capacity. Incredible, and actually not support. I was showcased. Thank you very much. There's a very big difference. We were at the demo house demoing our cool stuff. But what they've done is they've taken the Masters app that's for the iPhone and the TV and extended it to the Vision Pro, and you can like look at the green in 3D. You can have multiple videos going at once, etc. All different ways of experiencing an event, similar to way we talked about it in the Second Life days of going to an event, and was at Wimbledon, you could actually watch some of the match and follow the ball bouncing back and forth across. Anyway, so back to what's going on from my perspective, we're starting to see some really cool experiments coming out, and there's more and more apps literally every day becoming available for the Vision Pro, and this is just with 150,000 units. We know that WWDC is going to release, more than likely, 2.0 of the Vision Pro operating system. I'm on beta 3 of version 1.2 or 1.1. Anyway, a newer version that the average user who's not a developer doesn't have. So that is expanding. We know that Apple has committed to making the device available for more countries in the very near future. So I don't think we have a death knell of a new product, right? It's demand is right where it was. The big demand hit at first, and then it all was delivered, and now we're waiting for the next bow wave of demand. Now, the reason I think the May 7th event, which is billed as the iPad event, will also be a Vision Pro event, is I think they'll take the opportunity to announce one or more countries having it available, along with the rumor that the new Apple Pencil will also be available for 3D content on the Vision Pro. So that you can use the Pencil in 3D space. And I'm looking forward to that, to see how that plays out. So I'm still excited. I use it every day. I've got an app called Split Screen that allows me to have multiple Mac screens running at once. So it's not just the one shared screen.
Right.
I can basically run like I normally do with multiple monitors on my Mac. And I still find It's somewhat weird with eye positioning. I'm not an expert at it yet, right? As you're glancing between the screens, the cursor will move to the other screen.
Yeah, you mentioned that before, so that's still happening even in the beta, right?
Well, it's happening more so now with running multiple Mac screens. Because I will have two screens up, and I'm going to look at something in the one Mac screen while typing in the other, and the cursor will move over. Let alone when I have multiple Vision Pro apps running. So now you have multiple Vision Pro apps, which are totally independent of the Mac apps.
Right.
But wherever I happen to glance, suddenly my cursor is over there. So that is a usability thing that they're going to have to try to figure out, right? Either through better training or I had raised a bug early on because I kept seeing this circle with a red ring around it. And like I suddenly discovered that's my cursor.
Oh.
And when I looked up there, it would stay in certain screens periodically.
Huh.
And so it's kind of funky. That takes getting used to. But overall, I still love it. I still use it every day. Matter of fact, I continue to use it for my day job to allow me to focus and to get rid of the distractions around me while I'm working.
Cool. Well, thanks for that rundown, Michael. It's really cool that you're on the cutting edge of this and really getting the experiences right from the beginning, because that is part of what your developer background leads you towards. And it's going to be intriguing to see what comes next and what are the interaction points, for example, with new iPads that are going to come into the future, because I could see where the hardware and the software and the screens and the spatial computing are all going to be converging more and more and more as we go into the future. So we're going to be waiting with bated breath as to what happens with the announcement in WWDC as well.
I just can't wait to see what happens when it's available in other countries, supported and available in other countries, and to see what the developers there do.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, that's the whole idea. The developers, to quote some Microsoft guy, is sort of the important thing to get us where we need to be and create those compelling experiences that now drive more purchasers of the hardware and the software, right?
Well, speaking of compelling experiences, what do you think about developing in Excel?
So longtime listeners and new listeners will know that Games at Work is all about games and gaming technology and how it's being used for business. And what better way to combine both of those to create role-playing type games in Excel? It seems to be designed for us. So there's an example of Fallout, which, Fallout Boy and all the hype and structure that's going around from a TV experience these days. There was someone who created an example of Fallout in Excel, and I gave it a whirl today. It uses Dungeons and Dragons type style of gameplay, and it's a number of tabs in spreadsheets. And luckily for me, I don't have Excel on this particular device, so I was not enabling all the macros, but I was able to see, hey, there's a map of the environment and there are rules and tables and ways of creating characters, and you can manage your way through it. So how intriguing is this? It's a little bit more interesting, I think, than Doom on a particular small screen, like maybe on the Rabbit.
Well, I do have Excel, and I tried to play it, and I died pretty quick, and that's my experience with Fallout. Thank you very much.
There we go.
We do have a listener link on chess. That's a game we don't talk about very much, even though I do play it on Vision Pro, and it's loads of fun. So for people who are into chess and gaming, it's a 60-hour gameplay of chess. New world record by a chess champion,
Though not yet confirmed, right? Guinness still has to show your confirmation.
Well, hey, 59 hours would be pretty long too, right? Tunde Onokoya, I believe is how you pronounce his name. 60-hour straight marathon chess game in Times Square. This is amazing. And as someone who I tend to play chess too fast, right? There are some people who I think take way too long. 60 hours is pretty long. I don't see how you would have time. The physical stamina, let alone the mental stamina, for that minute, that playing chess that long.
Yep. It's quite an accomplishment, and what a cool.
Because I read nonstop, and I'm like, didn't you have to go to the bathroom?
I'm sure there were ways of allowing that. You know, maybe there was the time clock was able to put on pause, but
yes.
We have one last article that we want to get to today because we're nearly at time. Yes. And we've talked a little bit in the past about gaming companies. And we have an interesting story here, Michael, that you've locked into around a Swedish holding company that is now splitting itself up into several games based on the properties that they own.
Yeah, and this is really surprising. I'm sure you've heard of Tomb Raider.
Oh,
or
Lara Croft,
The Lord of the Rings. I guess that's something you've heard of before too.
Most people have, I suppose, by now.
Yeah. So this company, over the years, acquired the IP rights for gaming for Tomb Raider, Lord of the Rings, and others, and. Evidently, either they spent too much on them, or they did not invest enough on them to make their money back. But yeah, they're having to break it up because, I mean, these are landmark IPs. I can't tell you how many different ways I've spent money on Lord of the Rings games, right? Lord of the Rings Online, the various different versions that were kind of like Age of Empires. I don't even remember the names of those anymore. Other Lord of the Rings role-playing games and things, as well as, I mean, I think I have four or five different Tomb Raiders. All of them are spending money. And it is expensive nowadays to make a quality AA budget game. But it's surprising to me right now where we are on this IP not being able to make enough money for them, right? It says that we have an imbalance right now from a market perspective on investment and what we're charging and the payback. So it'd be interesting to see what's going to go on in the market right now from a consolidation perspective or a breaking it apart. And like, you know, famously Bill Gates said years ago, there's two ways to make money in software. Bundling and unbundling. I guess this is the unbundling part.
Interesting. Well, something to keep a close eye on, because the business of making games, like making movies, is not an inexpensive one, and exactly. And sometimes splitting out makes things a lot easier to go, right? Well,
I think, speaking of splitting out, I think it's time for us to split.
Yeah, it kind of is. We're at time here today. So, Andy, we missed you for this show, but we're going to be aiming to get people back together again. And, Michael, if someone's got a great idea for something for the show, how can they find us, reach us, and tell us about it?
I think the easiest thing they could do is remember our name and go to gamesatwork.biz.
That would certainly be a great choice. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again very soon. See ya.
Bye. You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.